We'll be reading the entire chapter. 2 Samuel 24, beginning at verse 1. And again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, "Go, number Israel and Judah." So the king said to Joab, the commander of the army, who was with him, "Go through all the tribes of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, and number the people that I may know the number of the people." But Joab said to the king, "May the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while in the eyes of the Lord the king still sees it. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing?" But the king's word prevailed against Joab and the commanders of the army. So Joab and the commanders of the army went out from the presence of the king to number the people of Israel. They crossed the Jordan and began from Aor and from the city that is in the middle of the valley toward Gad and on to Jazer. Then they came to Gilead and to Kadesh, to the land of the Hittites. And they came to Dan, and from Dan they went around to Sidon. And they came to the fortress of Tyre and to all the cities of the Hivites and Canaanites. And they went out to Negeb of Judah at Beersheba. So when they had gone through all the land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. And Joab gave the sum of the numbering of the people to the king. In Israel there were 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000. But David's heart struck him after he had numbered the people. And David said to the Lord, "I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly." And when David arose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying, "Go say to David, thus says the Lord, 3 things I offer you. Choose one of them, that I may do it to you." So Gad came to David and told him and said to him, Shall 3 years of famine come to you in your land? Or will you flee 3 months before your foes while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days pestilence in your land? Now consider and decide what answer I shall return to him who sent me." Then David said to Gad, "I am in great distress. Let us fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercy is great, but let me not fall into the hand of man." So the Lord sent a pestilence on Israel from the morning until the appointed time. And there died of the people from Dan to Beersheba 70,000 men. And when the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented from the calamity and said to the angel who was working destruction on the people, "It is enough. Now stay your hand." And the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. Then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking the people, and said, "Behold, I have sinned, and I have done wickedly. But these sheep What have they done? Please, let your hand be against me and against my father's house. And Gad came that day to David and said to him, go, raise an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. So David went up at Gad's word, as the Lord commanded. And when Araunah looked down, he saw the king and the servants coming toward him. And Araunah went out and paid homage to the king with his face to the ground. And Araunah said, why has my lord the king come to his servant? And David said, to buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be averted from the people. Then Araunah said to David, let my lord the king take and offer up what seems good to him. Here are the oxen and the burnt off for the burnt offering, and the threshing sledges and the yokes of the oxen for wood. All this, O king, Araunah gives to the king. And Araunah said to the king, may the Lord your God accept you. But the king said to Araunah, no, but I will buy it from you for a price. I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord, my God, that cost me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. And David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So the Lord responded to the plea for the land, and the plague was averted from Israel. We have finally come to the end of 1 and 2 Samuel. We've been preaching through these two books from I don't know when we started. But as we read, we understand that in our Bibles, Samuel is one book. And through the English and such, they separate the first and second. So it's one story. We come to the end of the story, the pinnacle of the story. And it's really the life of the king, King David, the king that God has chosen for his people as we've gone through this. If you remember the beginning of Samuel, it was that beginning, the end of the Judges, where, as we said, everyone did what was right in their own eyes, and we saw how bad the worship and the priesthood and all the things were in Israel. There was no leader, no king. God was truly their king, but they wanted a king like the other nations. And so we see Hannah's prophetical prayer that sets the stage for the book. And we've gone through the King Saul, and we saw how bad kings like the other nations. And yet, there was a man whom God had selected, and that was David. We saw how good David seemed. He's certainly a lot better than Saul. For the Lord was with him. The Lord promised he would not take his spirit from him. You see, on one sense, as we've seen, even as we've seen the downfall of David in certain ways acted, and we see here, David, in one sense, is no different than Saul, for they're both sons and daughters of Adam, or sons of Adam, and we're all sons and daughters. And so in that way, but because the Lord was going to do something, David was different. And yet, when we see the end of David, we see that the writer to Samuel ends David on a very sad note, doesn't it? It's interesting. Why does he include this sin of the census? We have questions this text. One is, why does he end with the sin of the census? Well, you know, why couldn't we end at where we had the mighty men and all those great things in chapter 20? Why chapter 24? The other question we have for this is, we say, what was the sin of the census? It's not explicit. We're going to talk about that. And so as we look at this text, we need to see it within the context of Samuel itself, first and second, as well as the redemptive history and God's promise. And of course, we can't miss that great chapter of 2 Samuel. And that is the one of the Davidic covenant God had added and promised to David of his descendant who would build the house. Because that also is a reason why we have chapter 24. Well, with that, I divided this text into three sections. The first is the sin and the census, verses 1 through 9. Second, the sin and the judgment, verses 10 through 17. And then finally, the sin and the altar, verses 18 through 25. So let's look at the first seven verses, the sin and the census. Could call that the sin of the census, but the sin and the census to keep things continuing through. Look at the beginning, though. The first words are so important and often get overlooked. Because it's not primarily here the sin of David that's in view. The writer tells us, again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. If you're reading through the Bible, I hope you are, you're going to continue to see the anger of the Lord being kindled against Israel. Read the book of Numbers. Read the book of Exodus. Read the book of Judges. Read the books not only of Samuel, but the Kings. It constantly, the Lord's anger is kindled against Israel. But of course, what we also see, this is not only the Lord, but the Lord also remembers what? He remembers the covenant. He remembers his promise. So there's a cycle there. The Lord remembering, but then remembering his grace. When the Lord sees and there's going to be judgment upon Israel, there's that tension that we always see. And there are sacrifices. We're going to talk about the sacrifice in the Mosaic Covenant. You know, when you sinned in Israel, as I said, you would bring your sacrifice, okay? And that would take care of the sin. But you'd have to do it again. And again, the Day of Atonement, author of Hebrews tells us. Every year you have to have a Day of Atonement. He says, in one sense, it was a reminder that they're always sinful. And that's what we need to see when it says, and again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. His covenant people. The people of Zion. And it is in that context that we read that difficult section of verse 1, that we're not going to focus on. A lot of people trying to argue for this, but it says this, and he incited David against them. This is the troubling passage for many non-Reformed Christians. And he incited, the Lord incited David against him. It was the Lord who incited David. Now, in Chronicles, the parallel in Chronicles says it was Satan who incited David. Well, which is it? Well, if you're Reformed, you understand that God sovereignly does things. He doesn't sin, but he uses people. He raised Pharaoh up to show his name. He hardened Pharaoh's heart. Pharaoh's heart was hardened. We call those secondary causes. And of course, a great passage. I'm not going to argue for this. I just want to say, God can do this. Remember when Jesus Christ was put to the cross and Peter's sermon, he says, you put to death the King of Glory by wicked hands according to what? The plan of God. And so to your questions here, the answer is simple. God is sovereign. And so God can, in his anger, in his wrath, incite the king of Israel against them. Now, we're going to see what ultimate outcome that is for us. Glorious outcome. Gracious outcome.
But it's because of Israel. We're going to see 70,000 people die.
But again, the cause here, the backdrop, is that Israel is a sinful people. And they continue to bring up the wrath of God. So, the Lord incited David against them and said, again, the text is saying, the Lord said to David, go and number Israel and Judah. This is part of God's wrath against Israel. And so David, the king, said to the commander, Joab, the commander of the army, remember Joab, to go through all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and number the people that he may know the number of the people. This was the sin. David is sending to number the people. Now, the question we have is, why was it a sin? It is not a sin for the king of Israel to number the people. It's not a sin. There's a lot of numberings of the people through the Bible. Moses does it. So it's not the numbering of the people that was sinful. Well, there are a number of things, and I'm going to give you the one that makes the most sense from the text. One answer the people give is in Exodus, it mentions that when you take a number of the people, you have to do a sacrifice, and certain sacrifices for that numbering, the payment. And people say, well, that was what it. He did the numbering, but didn't do the sacrifices. That doesn't really fit. It's possible, but it doesn't say he didn't do it. It would have said that in a number of places, by the way, where there's numbering being done. There is not a mention of an offering made. So just because it's not mentioned doesn't mean it didn't happen. And God didn't say that that was the reason. Well, so if it's not that, what is going on here? Well, I think the other possibility that people say is, well, since the numbering wasn't sinful, it must have been David's motive. And people try to think, what was David's motive? And what's most prominently coming forth is people saying, well, you see, David was putting his trust in the men of Israel, in the army of Israel, and not the Lord. Right? He's putting his trust in his military, not the Lord. That sounds pious on our part, but that doesn't make sense. How does the Lord win victories? Through the army of Israel. For David, it's not an either or. No, and there's no indication that that's what's going on here. I think the key to understanding this is, what was his purpose in numbering? It wasn't just any numbering. Notice who were numbered. We have the 800,000 to 500,000. It was the valiant men who drew the sword. And who did the numbering? Joab and the commanders. You see, Israel did not have a standing army. We have a standing army. We have the Marines, that you enlist and you're paid and you live. That's what you do. Israel didn't have a standing army. It had an occasional army. And the people would come. Think of it as a militia. That's how Israel's army was. And so when a thing happened where there was going to be a campaign, he would number and bring the people. That is what he's doing. He's preparing for battle. Well, why is that sinful? Well, I think the key of why it's sinful is understanding, again, God's promise to Israel. Back when God promised the land to Abraham, he promised him a certain territory of land. The land of the Canaanites and all this land from the rivers, from the great river to the great sea, from the north to the south. It was in the reign of David that God fulfilled those borders, that extension.
It didn't happen in the time of the judges. It didn't happen in the time of Joshua. God, through David, through his appointed king, had given Israel ultimately that physical inheritance. Just as his greater son will give us that inheritance. And what's going on here is David is seeking an army to extend the borders. There's a desire for more. I think that's what's going on here. Now, I don't know that for sure, but it does seem to be. If you look at when the servants went out, they crossed the Jordan and began at Aor. And that is in the land of Gad. It mentions in the valley of Gad. That's a member of the Gad and then Manasseh. So that's over there in the Transjordan. Then he goes up. Look at the thing. Then he goes up to Jazer, which is in Manasseh. This is on the east side. And it continues to go on up that east side. And then it goes up to Gilead up there. And then it finally crosses over. We're not sure where Kadesh and the land of the Hittites, because there's maybe texture problems, but it's up north there. If it was really Kadesh, it would be out of the land. It's not. But it's showing the full extent borders. Then it goes all the way up to Dan, which is the northern part. Then all the way over to Sidon and Tyre over here on the sea. And then it comes down to the south to Beersheba. And notice it even said to the cities of the Hivites and the Canaanites. It's like so it's the entire promised land. And how long did it take them? A long time. 9 months and 20 days. No, David is desiring more than the Lord had promised and gave him. By the way, I think we, in that way, we're a lot like David, right? Don't we want more? All right, then the Lord gives us and promises us. I told you about that marriage counseling I did. I learned about good biblical marriage counseling. Whenever you have a problem in your marriage, it's because your spouse is not doing what you want them to do. And then you're also mad at God. And the question is, did God promise you a perfect spouse? No. Now, we should strive to get better, but we ought not. We ought to work harder. We need to see that at the end of the day, this is one sense that we need to see that David needed to be content with what the Lord had given him. Israel was not a growing empire. They weren't evangelistic like we are in the church. It's only through his son that he will extend the whole world, not to David. So that was David's sin. And by the way, we see that the sin of David, it makes the most sense of the sin of David here, is that he's desiring more than the Lord had promised. Well, let's look at the judgment. First, we need to see the transition here is verse 10, the judgment. We need, as we see David's sin, we need to make a good point of David. Look at verse 10. David's heart struck him that he had numbered the people. And David says, I have sinned greatly. David knew that he sinned. There's growth in David, brothers and sisters, personally. You know what David is saying here? He's saying, I am the man. And I said that. Yeah, I see the smiles. Remember when David sinned with Uriah and Bathsheba? How did he admit his sin? It was when he was confronted by Nathan. Here, David confronts himself. There seems to be some growth in David. That's not the big part of this passage, but that's good. And that's what happens to us, isn't it? We grow. Our heart eventually does. We don't always do it. I'm not saying David's perfect from this point on, but there's growth in David. And then, what happens? Look what David asks for. David says, take away the iniquity of your servant. He wants the iniquity taken away. And now what the Lord does to connect with the sin is he offers David three choices of judgment. One is 3 years of famine in the land.
Second is 3 months of being chastened by your foes, or 3 days of pestilence or plague on the land. And look at David's response to that choice. There are two points that I don't think are often drawn out from this text. First off, David does not choose one of them. Everyone thinks that David is choosing the pestilence. I don't think that's what's going on here. I really don't. Because it is true that the enemies, he would have been in the hand of the enemies, but famine would not have put him in the hands of his enemies. Some try and say that, but I don't think that's what's going on. I think what David is saying is, God, let it be for you to decide. Basically, David is putting himself on the mercy of the court to let the judge make the decision. Now, I may be wrong. It may be, but I think that's the emphasis of the text here. But then there's a bad thing that David does here. Did you catch it? I may be reading too much, but look what he says to him. When he says that, he says, let, verse 14, second sentence. Let, what's the pronoun there?
Us.
Let us fall into the hands of the Lord. Well, okay, right? But look at the last phrase in that verse. But let me not fall into the hand of man. It's not, the parallel would have been, let us not fall into the hand of man. That's interesting, isn't it? Now, it could be that he's speaking of himself as a federal head, as a king. I don't know. Or it could be an indication of, hey, don't let me fall in the hand of men. We're going to make another point as we really apply that. But that's the judgment. You see David acknowledging, but ultimately he does not want to be placed in the hands of man. He puts himself into the hands of the Lord. And so now we have, and so what happens is the Lord does send a pestilence, whether it's the Lord's decision or David's. And it was from the morning until the appointed time, and we're told that from Dan to Beersheba, from the north to the south, an angel with an outstretched arm with a sword, that's the idea behind it, whether it's a real sword, no, that's a picture of what we see, he struck down 70,000 men. It's interesting. As he was looking to raise an army, we're told that 70,000 men died. But in God's judgment on Israel, and again, I would argue it stems back from verse 1 where it says the anger was kindled against Israel. God in this judgment is going to reveal his mercy and reveal revelation. And that's where we see in the judgment that prepares us for the altar. And when the angel stood out his hand, verse 16, toward Jerusalem to destroy it. Remember, this is the city where God placed his name. This is the city where he is pleased to dwell. The Lord relented. There's grace. In the midst of judgment, we see grace. The Lord relented from the calamity and said to the angel who is working destruction among the people, it is enough. Stay your hand. You can picture it, right? This angel has a sword raised up to destroy them, and God said, stay your hand. Stop. By the way, this is before David continues talking to the Lord. The staying began, or again, it's hard to start. It was God's idea to stay. It wasn't David's. It was God's mercy. And we're told that was a specific place where that happened. the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. Again, Jerusalem was a Jebusite city originally. Then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking the people and said, it's interesting, did this happen before God did it or after? We don't know, because it said who was striking the people, not who had struck the people. We're not sure. But as God decided to do this, the king also asked something. Now the king's different from what he said earlier. You see, he saw the people suffering. He saw the people, and his heart went out to them. And look what David says. Behold, I have sinned, and I have done wickedly. And I. In the Hebrew text, with the verb, you don't need a pronoun, but in each of these places, there's a pronoun supplied for emphasis. What David is saying to the king, what David is saying to his king and his Lord, I have sinned, I have done wickedly, and now he cares for the sheep. Before, remember, don't let me fall on the hands. Here he says, but these sheep, what have they done? Now, we know what they've done, don't we? Because we know. We've been reading our Bibles. They are always wickedly, always turned apart. But in David's eyes, he said, what about these people? They haven't done. He sees this judgment in connection with his numbering the people. What have they done? I have caused this calamity upon them. Please let your hand be against me. Wow. Let your hand be against me. He just saw what the Lord had done, hasn't he? 70,000 men. Not only against me, but what? Against my father's house. Here's a shepherd who's willing to be struck down for his sheep. See, that's the sin and the judgment as it's developed in David. And then finally, in response to David's cry here, is the command to build an altar, the sin and the altar. And so we're told that Gad came and spoke to David. Notice it's interesting. Gad is the one who's speaking, and we know that Gad is a seer, the spokesman for God's people. But see, look at the end of verse 19. I loved it when I looked at it. The verse 19 says this. So David went up at Gad's word, and then it says, at the command, at the Lord's command. You see, Gad's word is the Lord's command. And so he comes up, he's going to Ruth's house, and the threshing floor, and he sees the king and all these men, and he bows down and he says, what do you want? And David's going to offer this sacrifice. He's going to build an altar and offer a sacrifice to appease the wrath of the Lord against Israel, against David's own sin. And of course, as a good servant here, he's a Jebusite, but looks like he's part of Israel now. He says, no, take it. The land is yours. The land is yours. And by the way, the oxen, I don't know if you know this, but when he's talked about the threshing sledges were pieces used to do the threshing, because it's not going to be a threshing floor anymore. It's going to be an altar. He says, use that wood and the wood for the oxen. Use that to build your fire to do the sacrifice. But, and he says, the end of verse 23, it says, may the Lord your God accept you. Literally, it's may the Lord your God be pleased with you. May he be well pleased with you. But the king said, no. Remember, the king thinks it's his sin, and who has to pay for his sin? Not Aruah, it's got to be him. No, it's got to cost me. It's got to cost me something. And so, he pays 50 shekels of silver. It did cost David. And David built an altar there. and offered it to the Lord. Now, before we continue to the second half of the sermon, which will be a short one, hopefully very quick, I want to end on this, the sin of the altar. And I really, as I've been studying and reading this passage and praying about it, something struck me. And I talked to other people. What if David had decided to build the altar on his own? On this threshing floor? That would have been sin, right? He's building a separate altar. See, there are points before the Mosaic where Israel, where we see Abraham and the people of the land, they build altars to the Lord. But once God has the altar and the Holy of Holies and the entire sacrificial system, when Israel sins, that's where you go to appease the Lord, to do thank offerings and burnt offerings, to do them on high places that Israel do. That is wrong. It's very interesting that the Lord tells David to build this altar. Well, we're going to see, especially as we go to the second, that this is a linkage to what I call the second half of the sermon. Because we see David's context here, but within the Mosaic Covenant, this doesn't fit the Mosaic Covenant. It fits a time before the Mosaic Covenant. And you know where we see the connection? Well, I'm going to read, you write down this passage, I'm going to read 2 Chronicles 3, Verse 1. Then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to David, his father, at the place where David had appointed on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. See, what we're learning here, and we know this, this place, this threshing floor, is a place where the temple will be built, where Solomon built the temple. But we also know that it's called Mount Moriah. So where the temple is being built on Mount Moriah is where God stayed the hand of the angel from destroying Israel. There's another time on Mount Moriah where God stayed the hand from destroying Israel. You know where that is? Genesis 22. Israel in the person of Abraham's son. If Isaac dies, who else dies? More than 70,000, all of his descendants. These people all descend from him. Genesis 22, verse 1. After these things, God tested Abraham, said, Abraham, he said, here I am. He tells him to go to Mount Moriah and slay his son. But what happened? Abraham's hand with a knife is about ready to slay his son, and he says, Abraham, Abraham, don't do it. And then God provided a sacrifice. Isaac said, where is the lamb for the offering? Abraham said, God will provide a lamb. They found a ram, not a lamb, a ram. Because the Lamb of God had not come onto the scene yet. So before the Mosaic Covenant sacrificial system, we see this on Mount Moriah. And now, David, in a sacrifice outside the Mosaic, we see the stay of the land. And of course, that reminds us that there will be a time in which there will be a sacrifice in the New Testament outside the Mosaic Covenant. Jesus was not sacrificed according to the Mosaic Covenant. He was sacrificed as a fulfillment of what this typifies. You see, as David here, this is the picture of what's going to happen to Jesus on Calvary.
And there are some arguments of whether the temple was moved and whether the temple was originally on Mount Moriah where Calvary died. I'm not going to get into that. It doesn't necessarily mean, but it's what it connects. David says here, remember I said, David said, don't let me fall into the hands of men, wicked men. Jesus did. I said earlier that Satan incited David to get more than he had, right? Did Satan incite Jesus to get more than he had, more than his father had providentially given him? Yeah. We see that in his temptation. Same temptation. I can give you the kingdom right now. Don't go through that suffering. Don't go through all those things. Don't take that. Same. But unlike David, Jesus didn't sin. You see, that's important because if we read this text without that connection, then I'm just going to tell you as a preacher, don't be like David. My problem is we are like David. And as David said later, don't let me fall in the hands of men, I mentioned it. Jesus allowed himself to fall into the hands of men. He could have raised up legions of angels, but he willingly went so that God's wrath would be averted. Now, here's the difference between us and David. And all the Old Testament saints. They are safe like us. We will sit down with them. But in redemptive history, the wrath of God continued to flare up against them because his sin was not historically taken care of in the history of redemption. We read that beautiful passage in Romans 8. You should all be able to quote it. 8:1. What does it say? I want to hear everyone say it. There is now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus. Say it again. There is now no condemnation. David couldn't say that. He had the promise, looking forward to it. But until Jesus Christ did that one sacrifice that all this temple stuff pointed to, and the sacrifice of Isaac pointed to, until he did that, God's wrath continued to flare up. Whatever happens to you in this life, believer, is not God's wrath. Underline that. Put a star behind it. Yes, he is your father and he will bring us, but it's not his wrath. When David bought the land. See, David bought the land. It cost him silver. What did it cost Jesus? His life. So in that sense. And as David went, it was told, may the Lord be well pleased with you. And we hear twice in the New Testament, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Brothers and sisters, the sin and the census. The sin is an example of the sin that we all have, the sin and the judgment. There's going to be judgment, but in judgment, there's going to be the judgment of us is done on the altar. And Jesus takes it. He is the shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. Sinful and erring sheep. And that's why we confess it. We confess our sins not to leverage God's grace. We confess our sins knowing that we have God's grace. It was Christ who fulfilled all of this. And as we look at, see, this is why this sin of David is important. And I will end with a statement I heard from a sermon that helped me a lot on this. It's a sermon that mentioned an Old Testament teacher at Westminster Seminary years ago. And he said this, it is the office of the Old Testament to fail. It is the office of the Old Testament to fail. Whether it be David, whether it be Aaron, whether it be Levites, whether it be the judges, they fail because there is going to be the one who succeeds. It's not the blood of bulls and goats. For they can do nothing. It is only the blood of God's beloved, obedient Son. Let's go to Him now. Thank you.